We are going to start with Senator Bonhoeff's Senate File 347.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 347 is a bill which is intended to allow those people who, during this particular economic downturn, have been laid off and who are qualified for unemployment insurance to have the option of choosing Minnesota Care for a 5-month period so that they have unemployment insurance. And just so people understand, right now, when we have people apply for unemployment insurance, there's no medical benefits at all. But because of what's happening and the tremendous amount of layoffs we're seeing all over this state, we know that the worst thing that could happen for our state is to have these people become uninsured and then further complicate our ability to enact real health care reform going forward. Because the best thing we can do to get costs out of the system, as you all know here, is to make sure that everybody is covered. With the stimulus package, there is a provision for those who are eligible for COBRA to have 65% of the COBRA payment paid for with those stimulus dollars. So what this bill says is that for those people that for one reason or another are not eligible for the stimulus dollars and the COBRA plan, and number one, they also are not eligible for insurance through their spouse's employment, and they choose to participate in Minnesota Care, that they would, in fact, be eligible for this insurance. The way that we would pay for this insurance is through a mechanism where 10% of their unemployment check would be put into a savings account, in essence, a health care account that would be set up by the department. And so that money would be accumulated in that account. And in addition, there's a contribution that the business community would make in terms of their unemployment insurance. There would be a surcharge just for this 2-year period on the unemployment insurance. And the thing that is so hard to figure out exactly what that surcharge ought to be is that we don't really know how many of these people would take advantage of this opportunity. You know, we don't know how many will ultimately take advantage of the stimulus dollars. And so we're looking at what would the subset be that would qualify under this program that wouldn't be taking advantage of the COBRA. And based on that, we've gotten a fiscal note, and it actually came out higher than I had originally projected. And so I have proposed that there be a surcharge of 0.2% on the businesses. And based on the first draft of this preliminary fiscal note, I'm come up a slight bit short using those estimates and assumptions.
And Senator Bonhoeff, one of the things that we noticed in the fiscal note is that there is no offset for people that otherwise might have gone into Minnesota Care without this program. And so maybe we could see if someone from the department wants to come up and talk about that a little bit too here.
Madam Chair, Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. I think in the fiscal note it does assume that there will be some people not enrolling in this program because they'd be on Minnesota Care. It's
You need to listen to what I said.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Because we're having this problem a lot this year. I said there would be people that would choose to be in the Bonhoeff program that otherwise would have enrolled in Minnesota Care anyway, and we don't see an offset for that.
Well, that's something I'm not sure if that's something Mr. Hoffman considered or not.
But it doesn't appear to be considered in the fiscal note.
Okay. We can
look
into that.
So, you know, if there is some savings to Minnesota Care, then if there is a little bit short on the Bonhoeff program, it could probably be absorbed.
We will definitely look into that.
Thank you.
Kids.
Are there questions for...
And Madam Chair, I have Mr. Nelson here with the Department of Economic Development in case there are questions about the unemployment insurance program.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoeff, and perhaps to Mr. Greenman, on the preliminary fiscal note, it troubles me that even in a best-case scenario, with this going forward, it is estimated that it will take 10 months to complete the system's work for this proposal. And so consequently, the fiscal note assumes that this would not take place until July 1st of 2010. And I would just note that Senator Bonhoeff is trying to help Minnesota families. And Minnesota families need help today. They need help right now. And it troubles me greatly that apparently it's being suggested that we simply do not have the mechanism to be able to do that. And I think that that is problematic, not just for this particular proposal, but generally speaking, I think that's it's a huge concern for the division overall.
And Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, as I understand it, one of the reasons why that is, because I was equally concerned, is that if, in fact, the program pays for itself, it takes some time to build up a fund. So that's something that if the committee wanted to look at it in a different way, in terms of the cash flow allowing it to pay it back, we could look at a different
timing.
That
would be a possibility also. If we knew the money was coming in, we could advance the money and get paid back. But we would need to see a fiscal note that would show us then how much this would cost starting earlier if we were going to pay it back.
Madam Chair, I think the question about the systems impact from Senator Lynch has to do with whether we can get our major program computer systems up and running to take these people into the program, to determine eligibility, to enroll them, to set up a new system for mailing forms out, because this is going to be a new eligibility type. That's what I'm told by our system staff. So it sounds like it would take about 10 months to get the systems in place to actually take these people into the program.
My understanding when I heard this in the policy committee was that Senator Bonhoeff envisioned a form that simply would be given to people at the unemployment offices when they file for unemployment.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And they could fill out the form and send it in. So I'm not sure that you really need to get the systems changed in order to implement this relatively short-term program.
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Greenman.
My understanding is that the Department of Employment and Economic Development will provide DHS with information with which to determine eligibility, but that information would then go to DHS, and we would determine eligibility and enroll the person in the program. And it would be a new eligibility type.
Mr. Greenman, couldn't the eligibility information on the form be scanned manually and a determination made on the eligibility? And if they're eligible, then they could just be put into the system without changing the computer system?
Madam Chair, I'm afraid I'm not able to answer that question. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, maybe we could hear about these 22-plus FTEs that are needed for the program.
Madam Chair, my understanding from our eligibility staff is that they would need one person for about every 775 enrollees to enroll them in the program to determine eligibility and assist them in getting enrolled.
Madam Chair?
Well, if I could just follow up with this. My understanding is that DEED is actually doing all the work, and all you're doing is entering the information into the computer system.
Our understanding, excuse me, Madam Chair, our understanding from reading the bill is that DEED is going to provide us with the information to make the determination.
Well, essentially, they've done all the work, kind of as my analysis of this. So it does seem a little, perhaps overly aggressive request. All the information, all the necessary information would be provided to you by DEED. It isn't like a normal Minnesota Care application that might be missing information.
Madam Chair, I can certainly take this back and talk to the people who made the projections.
That's what we would hope you would be doing. Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I do have an amendment to the A6 amendment. And, Madam Chair, if you wouldn't mind why that's being passed out. Basically, Senator Bonhoff was saying that the surcharge would be a two-year surcharge on businesses or on unemployment insurance. And I believe that the preliminary sheet here on the unemployment law from DEED is 0.1%, and you're increasing it to 0.2% on businesses. Is that correct, Senator Bonham?
Madam Chair, it's actually 0.2, and it's split up. 1% goes to the dislocated worker account, and 1% to the health care account. But I would let Mr. Nelson comment.
Listen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I am the Director of Legal Affairs for the Unemployment Insurance Program. Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, to your question, it was set up this way to avoid collection costs imposed by the Department of Labor because the unemployment insurance tax is collected with federal funds. If we do any state tax on top of it, there is a collection cost required to be paid. So what this is doing is piggybacking on the current workforce development fee, but for a variety of reasons constructed it the way it is. But really, all the new fees added is a 0.1%. But it's just how it's structured in the bill. Like I say, to save collection costs is why it's structured the way it is in the bill. But the new assessment, if you will, is 0.1%, which will raise approximately $50 million a year.
Okay, Madam Chair, and then Senator Bonhoff, what was the 0.2% increase that you figured was going to have to occur, which for me is very troubling because in the time right now of our economic situation, we have to protect our businesses, and any tax, any fee, any increase on a surcharge that's going to be directed and influence our business climate in this state, I'm very troubled about.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, Mr. Nelson will explain further, but that is not an additional fee. Again, it's the way that the language is stated to accommodate putting the 0.1% into this special account.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, to your question, but if you see on line page 3, line 14, and line 15, the current 0.1% assessment for the Workforce Development Fund is suspended, and then there's this 2%, 0.2% put on. So you're suspending a 0.1%, putting on a 0.2%, so the net increase is 0.1%. And like I say, the reason why this is structured that way is, again, to save on collection costs. So there actually is an increase of 0.1% on employer payrolls up to the first 26,000 in wages paid. So it's an additional $50 million assessment on Minnesota businesses.
Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen, I can just tell you that your amendment is kind of where Senator Bonhoff started out. And in talking with her about her bill, I told her, short of a huge unforeseen miracle in one of our ideas to save money around here, the fund doesn't really have the money to do this. The fund, before the FMAP money came in, was projected to have a deficit in 2013. And, of course, some of the things coming along will cause some savings, but I certainly don't anticipate savings of this magnitude. So that's why she reworked her bill to try to generate some revenue to cover it, because I told her that if there wasn't revenue to cover it, it wasn't likely to be able to be happening.
Madam Chair, I understand that. I do know there is a fund balance right now that over $280 million. Is that correct?
Well, it is not projected to last. We were projected in the November forecast to have a deficit in 2013.
Well, Madam Chair, for the record, I do believe that we have to be very careful about what we do to our business climate in the state. And this is just one more thing that you can add to the pile that occurs in this state. And that's why when Senator Lynch was talking about doing this for Minnesota families, I completely agree that this is a wonderful progress to helping our Minnesota families and the whole unemployment issue. But I really do believe that it should come out of the Health Care Access Fund. And so I would like
so
to
would
move
you like
the A6.
Pursue the amendment?
Yes,
okay.
I would. Thank you.
Senator Rosen has moved the A6 amendment. Is there any discussion? Senator Lurie.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm just wondering about the routing of this bill. Has this been through taxes, or would it go to taxes to look at this very issue?
Madam Chair, this bill has not been through taxes.
Okay. So, I mean,
Senator Bonhoff, does it need to go to taxes? My understanding is that unemployment fees
it's not its tax. Okay.
Do not go through the tax committee.
Okay.
And I believe it's been through the other committees that deal with that fund.
Business industry. Madam Chair, there's one more committee it would go through, and it would be Senator Tomasoni's committee.
Well, there'd be two more then, because it would have to go through full finance.
Yeah, full finance.
Also.
Yes, thank you.
And I guess I'm, we're not ready to send it on to Tomasoni yet. We need to get some more work done on the fiscal note, I think.
Madam
so
Chair.
Anyway, this amendment. Any discussion, Senator Fischbach?
I'm just wondering: is this $50 million that we would be increasing in addition to the $2 billion that is proposed in new taxes under the budget balancing plan? So this would be in addition to the $2 billion, or is it part of the $2 billion in new taxes?
This is a separate bill, so
okay.
Whatever happens with this is standing on its own.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, with regard to the additional 0.1% on the unemployment tax surcharge, I too was troubled about adding anything to the business community at this time. Yet when I look at what they're telling us are their biggest cost drivers across the state, it's healthcare and the healthcare costs. And so I know that long term, this, you know, small surcharge, if we can keep these people during this interim employed so that we're not putting a whole new group of families back out onto the emergency room, you know, non-compensated care, that we are saving money and that we are taking costs out of the overall system. And so I think ultimately this will be a surcharge that they will willingly support.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Could we perhaps hear from Ms. Hartwig? I don't even know your married name. I'm sorry, Beth, from the Minnesota Business Partnership.
Yes, we can take some testimony on the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Rosen, Beth McMullen. I represent Minnesota Business Partnership. I appreciate the opportunity to address Senator Bonhoff's bill and specifically Senator Rosen's amendment. The business partnership opposes Senate File 347 as drafted because of the surcharge on the unemployment wage taxes. We also have some concerns with the policy of the bill, but I won't address those at this time. I'll just stick to the surcharge. I understand Senator Bonhoff's concerns about the unemployed people joining the ranks of the uninsured and increasing the overall cost of health care in our state, but we don't think that this is the right way to do that. This surcharge that is used to pay for this would increase the burden on those businesses who are struggling in this economic downturn. This is supposed to be a short-term program, and there is, in the next biennium, my understanding is a $235 million surplus in the health care access fund. And this would be an additional tax, as you heard, $50 million a year on businesses. Now is not the time to be increasing costs on our job creators in this state. It's our understanding that this bill is essentially waiving some of the restrictions for entering Minnesota care, giving immediate access to people who are recently unemployed. This is what the Healthcare Access Fund was created to do, is to support Minnesota care. It's just unclear why we would need to create a new tax to pay for this, which is essentially a temporary expansion of Minnesota care. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So just if my comments weren't clear, we really don't have the money to do this. We have to balance this fund out over a four-year period. And there's a deficit in 2013. So I would say that if this amendment passes, we'd have to lay the bill on the table. Any further discussion? Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, I think there's one more person that would like to testify.
Madam Chair, Jeremy Essenson with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'll try not to repeat what Ms. McMullen said. We have two concerns. One, the new surcharge. In 1990, we saw a surcharge which was then called the dislocated worker tax. It was a tenth of a percent. It was to be sunsetted in 1991 on the UI taxes. The legislature came back the next year, removed the sunset provision, and that fee continues to be collected. And at some point, it turned into the Workforce Development Fund that Mr. Nelson referenced. But that tenth of a percent has continued to collect more money than the original program needed since its inception. And the money was then rolled over into the general fund. So we have some concerns that any surcharge could theoretically, even though it's sunsetted, be continuing into perpetuity. And our second concern is that in addition to the $50 million or so dollars per year, this would cost employers. With the increasing unemployment numbers, the most recent projections are showing that with no changes in law, businesses are going to have to pay about an additional $200 million per year just to cover those costs.
And so just to be clear, it would not be my intention that we continue this fee for any purpose in this division.
And I also want to thank Senator Bonhoff for listening to our concerns and working with us. And we're making progress, but we're still very concerned about the surcharge.
Okay. Any other discussion or questions? Seeing none, those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The amendment is not adopted. Are there any other questions on the bill? I think we're going to need to lay the bill over, so... Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoeff, just to reiterate on, as you continue to work on the fiscal note, I don't see it noted in the bill language itself, although I may have missed it, but your preliminary fiscal note indicates that enrollment may not be made until after July 31st of 2011. And the bill's effective date is January 1st, 2010. So I would just encourage us to take a look at the dates that are contained within the bill and work with the fiscal staff to, it seems like there needs to be more clarity about when we need to have this started.
And Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, the program ends in the 2011. So you can no longer be part of it. We're assuming that this this program is to address the current economic downturn, and that by that time there's going to be economic growth, and if not, then in fact we will have solved making sure everybody at least has health insurance.
Any other questions? So Senator Bonhoeff will set this aside. Being that it has to go to another division, I want it to be in good shape before it leaves here.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for taking this bill this morning and for your comments and the work that was done on the bill.
Members, there are some bills on the agenda today that are not going to be taken up because of the fiscal note issues, and I'd like to announce those so that if people are here for those bills, they do not need to stay. They would be Senate File 502, Senate File 1343, Senate File 1442. So you can just cross those off your agenda. Next bill is Senate File 704. Is Senator Dahl here?
Senator Dahl's in one recommended area.
Well, if he's not here, then we'll take another bill. And he can. The next bill is Senate File 758. Senator Moa, is she here? Okay. Senator Lori.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 1053, compulsive gambling appropriation. I have an author's A1 amendment is in your packet. I'd like to adopt to get the bill in shape.
One amendment would delete the Commissioner of Human Services and insert the Gambling Control Board. Any discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. So that would mean that this bill, if it passes, this division would have to go to another division also.
Right. This actually takes it out of our budget area and puts it in another. And, you know, as such, I'm happy to describe the bill, the reason for the change, whatever.
Yeah, I think that would be a good idea. If we're losing something out of this division, we probably should hear about it.
Yeah. the Commissioner of Human Services has overseen this contract for some time, and it's been, the Alliance has been a really unique partnership with the state in helping with public awareness and education regarding problem gambling, an issue that we really need to pay continuous attention to. And it's a relatively small grant in terms of the Department of Human Services overall projects, and there's been a good deal of tension between the provider groups and the department regarding the outreach efforts done. Several members and I have been working with the provider groups and the department to begin to address some of these issues, and the Gambling Control Board is in a unique position to actually help enhance the partnership that we're trying to create. They travel the state and work with all of the gambling entities around the state and have expressed a willingness to start overseeing this program, and the department is recognizes some of these issues and thinks that it would be wise to bring the Gambling Control Board in to look at this one relatively limited program and start working again on the awareness and education pieces that the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance has performed for the state for a long time. I do have Roger Svensson, the executive director of the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance. I've also got Don Feeney from the Minnesota Lottery, the granting agency that provides the funds. This is out of state lottery funds, I should note, not any general funds. And in your packet, you'll find some of the material 2008 in review from the North Star Alliance, as well as an annual, the sixth annual Minnesota Problem Gambling Conference coming up in May. It gives you some idea of the good work that's done and would continue under the Gambling Control Board. So, I mean, I would...
You know, since
support.
This is the first hearing on this bill,
yes.
I think we should just ask if there's anyone who wants to testify against the bill. Appears not to be anyone. So are there any questions from the committee about the bill? No questions? Okay, then you want to make your motion, Senator Laurie?
I move Senate File 1053 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Is that the correct motion, I believe?
Does it need to go to another division?
It needs to go to another division within Finance would be my understanding. So we'll send it back up to the top and they'll re-refer it. That's my...
Okay. Just make sure you let them know that's what they need
to do.
Yes,
I will do that.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Madam Chair and members.
Senator Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm here to present to you the Vulnerable Adult Act, which has to, from Senate File 758. Madam Chair, members, we, in the bill, we asked for the creation of a common entry point reporting system to streamline the multiple reporting systems that are in place right now, both at the state level and at the county level. And that's the major cost factor that is involved in this bill. I bring to you in this committee, I would the A7 amendment, which would, in working with the department, strip that new requirement from the bill, therefore stripping all the money expenses that are in the bill, leaving only the major policy issues that have been before both the judiciary, the commerce, and the health policy committees, just leaving in the policy language changes. And so I have the department here to speak to the A7 amendment to verify that we are taking out all the money expenses that are implicated in this bill.
Senator Coring?
Madam Chair, I would like to move the A7 amendment for my good friend, Senator Moore.
Senator Coring moves adoption of the A7 amendment. Is there any discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Now, is there someone here from the department?
Madam Chair, my name is Deb Siebenaller, and I am from the department, and I can testify that this amendment does remove all the fiscal implications associated with this bill.
Okay. Then we'll assume that there'll be a fiscal note for the full finance committee that will state that.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen won't hear the bill if there isn't. Just so you know, we're a little bit more lax here, because we know we have one more stop before we're finally done. So, Senator Coring, would you like to move the bill as amended for your good friend, Senator?
I would very much like to move the bill for my good friend. I would so move that Senate File 758, as amended, be recommended to pass. And is it referred back to the Finance Committee?
Yes.
Yes.
Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, Senator Coyne.
All right. Senator Dahl is apparently presenting a bill in taxes, so we'll come back to him later. Why don't we go to Senator Lori then next on Senate File 854.
Chair and members, Senate File 854, the Disability Developmental Disability Program Services Modifications. We heard this bill, a couple of weeks ago in health policy, and did say that this was part of an ongoing process where we'd been working with all stakeholders and that we did expect some amendments. We've made significant progress, which did result in actually a delete everything amendment that I would like to offer at this time. We will need to discuss it at length, but I'll offer it up and then would like to set it next to the fiscal note that I received yesterday and kind of step through and address what the A3 amendment would do. So I'll move the A3 amendment.
Any discussion of the A3 amendment?
Madam Chair, are we going to discuss it before we adopt it?
We will need to. It's not an author's amendment. We've been heard
right,
before.
Right, but we do.
So
we need to move it. So
now it's on the table.
It's
and
on
I'll
the
step
table.
You through it. And so with that, and maybe what I'll do is try to, since this is the policy, the fiscal committee, I'll try to tell you what the fiscal note is and how we're going to change it so that you can track as we go through it real quick. If you turn to page 4 of 7 of the fiscal note, which is rather large, in the way it's drafted, but this delete all will take care of almost all of the fiscal implications. So section 1, you'll see, has some cost savings. We, of course, will keep that. Section 9, the expanding variable rates piece, has some significant costs, and as I go through, I will be incorporating an oral amendment to the delete all that will eliminate the piece that caused those. The single set of standards, there were some pieces I'll discuss as we go through the amendment that should reduce those, but that will be kept. That'll be the only piece that'll have any cost associated with it. The comprehensive assessment, we are pulling out of this bill. That is the lion's share of the fiscal cost. So that's just a 40,000 foot real quick before we step through the amendment. I should say that the comprehensive assessment is, of course, in other bills, and we are in strong support of it. I think it would be a really good tool for elderly services. You know, we were talking about it for the PCA redesign. We talked about it for the non-emergency medical transportation. I mean, I think the comprehensive medical assessment is something that we'll need to address, but it has been dropped from this bill. So with that, I will step members through the A3 delete all amendment and explain as we go how it's changed from the first engrossment that we have in our packets. Section 1 I'll return to in 1 minute because Section 2 is the old Section 1, which is licensure. There is a small cost savings that we said we would keep on this. The only thing we really changes is we add a limit of 10 counties. This currently a provider must submit an application for a county for each county in which waivered services are provided, and that's a $500 fee, and there's some providers that operate in multiple counties and their clients reside in the region, and they've got a couple here and a couple there, and we're going to try to allow them to operate under one license. There's some savings, and we added in the A3 a limit of 10 counties and some comfort language for the counties had some concerns about foster care licensing, so those are added to incorporate those, and I don't believe anybody has any concerns left on that. Section 3, the overnight supervision, there's no fiscal impact in this, and actually it's the same as the DHS language in the licensure bill, and it would essentially allow, in limited circumstances, some electronic tools to be used for overnight supervision rather than 24/7. On-site staff. Sections 1 I'll return to. Actually, there's background studies, and these are in Sections 1, Sections 4 through 10, Sections 12 and Sections 13. There's a lot of language here. The crux of it is that currently background studies are done by DHS or the licensing county, and sometimes by both. The duplication of these studies is time-consuming and results in additional costs. The crux of all of these sections, again, 1, 4 through 10, 12, and 13, are to turn the background studies over from the counties over to DHS. We worked all of this language out with DHS in a manner such that there's no fiscal note attached to the way that it's done here. And, you know, we'll continue to hear the providers support it. In talks with the counties, we don't know of any opposition to this. It should just be elimination of duplication of time-consuming and additional costs associated with the background studies. So that brings us to Section 11 on page 9 in the Delete Everything Amendment, which is license holder record keeping. The only real changes from the engrossed version are that some technical issues were worked out with DHS licensing. This is currently if a provider does not hear back from DHS on a background study submitted, the burden is on the provider to notify DHS, and we're eliminating that. DHS agrees. There's no fiscal implications on that. Section 14 on page 11 in the Delete Everything, the A3 Delete Everything, is ICFMR contract provisions. It's the elimination of an annual quality assurance plan that DHS doesn't use anymore. It's also carried in the DHS continuing care bill, their policy bill. Section 15 is actually one of the ones that I do need to incorporate an oral amendment into the A3 amendment. I would like to delete section page 13, lines 4 through 6, which is allowing variable rates to be used in additional long-term care settings. If we do that, that will eliminate, that's the only piece that caused any fiscal note on this section within the DHS.
Okay, so Senator Lori incorporates that change on page 13 into his amendment.
Section 16, also on page, still on page 13, is GRH and MSA shelter needy. Truthfully, there's no fiscal note on here, but we were really hoping to see some savings, and we'll try to work with DHS and continue to pursue that. But currently, group residential funding is only available to people in a 24-hour supervised living situation. And this would allow people to reside in something other than that 24-hour supervised living situation. Right now, there are people that are living in this situation because they need the housing, not because they need that whole bundle of services that come along with it. And this would allow them the option, if it's budget neutral or creates a savings, they could move to another setting, and we could realize those cost savings. And I guess I'd like to work with DHS on that a little bit to see if we can get some savings booked. There was also some language in there added for the advocates. Basically, there is a little bit of concern about this, and so the way it's drafted now, it's a two-year project. It sunsets after 2 years, and the Department of Human Services would send a report back to us about how it's working, and I think that's a wise thing to do. Section 17 on page 15 of the A3 amendment is establishing a single set of standards. And this section requires a single set of standards to be developed to govern all services to people with disabilities in home and community-based services. That's actually a narrowed scope. It's narrowed to just those people in home and community-based service waivers. And it actually took out one of the pieces that caused some of the cost. There initially was a part of the plan was to develop a plan to bring the private sector compensation in line with the public sector compensation, and that has been completely removed. You'll see that in the fiscal note that they thought that would actually drive some of the saving, some of the costs associated with developing this plan. So again, we'll work with DHS to get a revised fiscal note on that piece. Let's see, section, uh-oh, now I lost, I didn't.
You are on section 17.
Right, and I didn't, right, okay, there it is. Section 18 is a common service menu for home and community-based services, and this would provide for the full array of services available regardless of the waiver type. It's just instructions to the Commissioner of Human Services to develop those. A few other changes from the way it was introduced. We deleted a few extra sections regarding obsolete rulemaking references. They're carried in other bills. Again, we eliminated Compass to address the largest piece of the fiscal note. That's what the A3 amendment does, and would stand for questions, and I have Bruce Nelson and Barb Jacobson from ARM to help with any questions. And
so are there any questions about this amendment? Senator Lynch.
Senator Lori, on page 16, line 16.10, this is the section of the bill where you're establishing a single set of standards. This is one of my favorite sections of this bill and the work that you're doing. And you and I have talked a little bit about this, but on line 16.10, you are suggesting that this group be convened, the commissioner is doing some work, to meet all or some of the requirements of this section.
Mm-hmm.
And Senator Lori, it just seems to me that we need to do everything we can to provide clarity to the agency and to the departments. And so I'd like to suggest on line 16.10 that the words all or some of be deleted. So it would read, panel established by the commissioner in 2008 to meet the requirements of this section. So I would offer that amendment, and I'd be interested in your comments.
I don't have any comments. I'm fine with it. I think it'd be fine.
Any further discussion of that amendment to the amendment?
I would incorporate that as.
All right. That's been incorporated by the author. Any further discussion of the amendment? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Lori. And continuing on that note, I don't have an additional amendment, but in establishing this single set of standards, I think your intent, and as I read the bill, it's broad, but I do hope that the group assembled is widespread, comprehensive, and will most certainly include representatives of the Region 10 Quality Council.
I believe that it does. It is widespread. It is the reason we didn't go into it more in the bill is because it would subject us to a whole bunch of additional state and local requirements, and we already had this group comprised, and it is a broad-based group, and I believe Bruce can speak to it.
Yeah.
Madam well.
Chair, Senator Lynch, we've been talking with the Region 10 people throughout this bill, and Senator Lori is correct. We did not include specific language for two reasons. One, we start narrowing certain things, then you build a Christmas tree, and we just wanted to keep that keep it wide open, and with the assumption and the understanding that Region 10 would be involved, and the principals and the goals of Region 10 would be involved as well. And we didn't want to put another fiscal note into the bill, so we didn't put that language in too. But it is our intent, and we will make sure we follow through, should this bill become law, that Region 10 is at the table.
Madam Chair, Senator Lori, thank you very much.
Any other questions? Senator Sharon.
Senator Lori, can you tell me what problem you're addressing with this establishing a single set of standards? Would you define that again? If you talked about that, I need to get that clearly integrated in my mind.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna let Bruce. He's been working on this more than me. I can take a step, but I think, and we can talk further. But we'll let Bruce.
Yeah, Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Nelson.
Senator Sharon, and I didn't introduce myself before. I'm Bruce Nelson with ARM. We looked at a couple sets of circumstances that are going on. One is the fiscal crisis, and we need to find some cost savings and be more cost effective. The other is the movement in this state and directives from CMS to have more person-centered, outcome-based, quality-based services. As we looked at the array of statutes and rules that govern home and community-based services, there are 11. And many of them are duplicative, and many of them really cause a lot of unnecessary administrative work without further enhancing the safety of people, and in fact actually limit the independence and flexibility that individuals and providers have. So the intent was then let's look at the array of all of those and make changes in all or some of them and hopefully come up with a single set of standards that govern services for people with disabilities in home and community-based services.
Senator Bergman, follow up.
Senator Sharon.
During the healthcare reform meetings, we had a subcommittee that looked at trying to reduce these kinds of complexities. So this fits very much in line with the recommendations of that subcommittee. But then my follow-up question would be, what I get concerned about when you get a single set of standards is that everybody tries to pile everything in there, and it takes away then the ability for the consumer to select just those services that they need. The cost savings is in that rather than having to take a whole package that may or may not, that's costed in a certain way, that does not, is really not needed by that consumer. So when you get all these stakeholders together putting together a set of standards, everybody wants to make sure that everything is in there. What can we do, or what in this assures me that we're talking about perhaps a minimum basic set of standards that can have some adjustments to them?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon.
Mr. Nelson.
We are certainly not going to do anything to undermine the mandates of the Vulnerable Adult Act or Maltreatment of Minors Act. But if you look on page 16 and line 2, we think, and we've had many discussions with individuals and have changed the language from initial introduction, but we think that the people closest to the consumer, and they can include the family, the friends, the healthcare providers, the service providers, and an array of people who are typically guiding decisions through interdisciplinary teams, psychologists that are needing and what are needed and whatnot. To really, in conjunction with the risk management plan that the individual has, to come up with what does this person need? Mm-hmm. What does this person want? And to design a system that allows those individuals, the closest to the individual and the individual, to be making those decisions.
Just one more follow-up, sure. Just to make sure I understand that what you're saying to me is, though, even though there'll be a single set of standards, the capacity for an individual to design their own menu of services exists within this, which means they can refuse some of the services or some of the expectations because it doesn't fit with them individually. I'm assured that this language accomplishes that.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, that is our
intent.
Nelson. I believe it does, and I trust that in a couple of years we're going to find savings.
I believe that.
In doing that.
And the other thing,
Senator Lori,
Madam Chair, and Senator Sharon, that I would point you to is again on page 4 of 7 of the fiscal note. DHS is also, of course, very sensitive to the creation of a runaway program where we just offer everything up and people could utilize it, and they have assigned no cost to building that single set of standards and putting it out. The cost associated with the single set of standards is an administrative cost in developing it, and that's all I see in the fiscal note developed.
Any further discussion? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Lori, again on page 16, line 16.21, hopefully to further assist you and to provide more clarity. On 16.21, I would move that the words all or a part of
I would incorporate
be deleted.
That.
What line are you on?
16.21, Madam Chair. Delete the words all or a part of.
Senator Lori incorporates that into the amendment. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then we'll vote on the A3 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. I'd like to request the department do a new fiscal note based on the amendment. We'll lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Dahl here yet? No? Okay, then we'll go on to Senator Pretner Solon. Senator File 1911.
Madam Chair, Senate File 1911 is a bill that was brought to me by the Board of Dentistry, which is seeking two policy changes, some technical changes, and some fee restructuring. And the first policy recommendation is to change the classification of dental assistants from registered to licensed. The second change the Board is asking for is to revise the definition of the practice of dentistry to be clear that teeth whitening is within the scope of the practice of the dentist, and that anyone performing teeth whitening commercially who is not a dental professional is practicing dentistry without a license. The technical changes suggested by the board include clarifying the supervision of students, examination requirements, updating terminology, and clarifying CPR requirements, that's cardiopulmonary resuscitation requirements, for dental professionals. These provisions were heard and discussed at length in Senator Marty's committee last Friday. There is no fiscal impact on the board or state as a result of these proposed changes. The proposed changes that do have fiscal implications include the establishment of fees related to the licensure process for foreign-trained dentists in obtaining limited general licenses, which was a bill we passed last year. This includes credential review, application fees, and the LGL fees, the license fees. These fees will offset costs to the board for regulating these licensees. The other area that contains fiscal implications is the adjustment of fees related to dentists holding sedation or anesthesia permits, which better reflect costs to the board for regulating these permits for application, certification, renewal, and reinstatement. And with me today is Marshall Schrag, who is the executive director for the Board of Dentistry. There is a fiscal note. Unfortunately, we received this even after your committee started today, so it has been difficult. And there are some errors in here, and I think Mr. Schrag can explain those to you.
All right. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you very much. I'm Marshall Schrag. As Senator Pretner Solon said, I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Dentistry, and I appreciate your taking this bill up. As far as the preliminary fiscal note goes, there are a couple of changes that are quite significant. On the first page,
this note was prepared by your board.
It was prepared by our board, and then
yes,
that's right. Do you want to know how that process works?
Not really.
Okay. Oh, good. Anyway, what it indicates here as far as the net expenditures line from the Special Revenue Fund is that in fiscal years 10 and 12 and 13 that the large expenditures would be continued at $100,000 per year. My belief is that those would go down to $10,000 or even zero. The larger expenditures are initially in fiscal year 10, $140,000. $40,000 of that is to establish the new license type for LGLs within our database. And the $100,000 per year for 10 and 11 has to do with what we anticipate would be contested case costs of pursuing or litigating cases having to do with the unlawful practice of dentistry in tooth whitening cases. And that's based upon what's happened in other states. Once those are resolved, we believe that that will not be an issue in subsequent years.
Okay. So, Senator Prettner-Sullen, my intention would be to delete the sections that have to do with fees from your bill, to lay them on the table here so that they could be included in the omnibus bill, but not to have all this other language in the omnibus bill and to let the rest of the language go separately. That will also give us time then to get a final fiscal note from the Board of Dentistry with the proper numbers in it.
Madam Chair, would that affect the policy involved or connected with those fee changes, or just the fee changes themselves?
I think all we need is just the fee changes.
I believe then that you're looking at revenue impact in sections 28 and 29 and sections 31 through 34.
So, Senator Prettner-Sullen, would you like to make that motion?
So, Madam Chair, I would move that sections 28 and 29,
31 through 34,
and 31 through 34 be deleted from the bill.
And what about over section 22?
You are correct, Madam Chair and Council, that that does in line 1319 involve a potential fee increase for the licensed dental assistant. So that right. would also.
So we've got section 22, 28, 29, 31 through 34. Want to just take another quick look and make sure we got it all?
Do you need 34? 34. Oh, that actually, you're correct, Council, Madam Chair. Section 34 does not affect the fee at all. It's just a language correction.
So it would be 31 through 33 then. Okay. Double check here, make sure.
So what is that, 22 through?
Okay, so Senator Prettner-Sullen moves to delete those sections. Leave them on the table here.
Madam Chair, could Council or could some, I want a list of those sections. Could someone go through that?
22, 28, 29, 31 through 33.
Madam Chair, would they stay here in this committee? Then?
Yes. Okay. This is a way to let the policy sections of your bill go forward.
I appreciate that, Madam Chair.
Not make our bill quite as thick as it otherwise might be.
Oh. Sure.
You should ask.
What's this? Any other discussion of that amendment? There's a section dealing with a fine regarding whitening. Or it's an enforcement costs of the whitening section.
Which section is that?
Section 3. It does have a fiscal impact in the bill, even though it doesn't relate to a fee.
Right. That does not affect a fee. That if that does pass, that would indeed have a fiscal impact on the board for enforcement.
Right. And so we would need to be appropriating that money in the omnibus bill. So I think we need to keep that section here also.
Okay.
You are correct, Madam Chair. In that case, there's also costs involved in establishing the LGL, the limited general licensure, credential review, and fees associated with that license.
And what section is that?
That would be...
That's section 28. We already have that on our list.
Okay. Good.
So I don't know how many more of these we have, but I'm just going to tell you that this is what I plan to do with all these kind of bills, so you can be prepared when you get to the committee. Any further discussion on the motion to delete section 3, 22, 28, 29, and 31 through 33? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the motion is adopted. Now, Senator Pretner Solon, do you want to make a motion on the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, then I would move that the bill that Senate File 1911 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the floor.
It would go to full finance.
Okay.
There's no way I can avoid it. You might want to talk with Senator Cohen about possibly making a motion.
Sure.
So you don't have to clog up that committee.
Okay.
Any further discussion of that motion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Senator Pretner Solon then has the next bill also, that's Senate File 525.
Yes, Madam Chair, you've heard this bill numbers of times over the last couple of years. This came from a constituent who has worked in the tattoo industry, and he brought this to my attention that there is no state standard in place for regulating body artists or tattoo parlors in Minnesota. His name is Ryan Wells. Unfortunately, he had an accident to his arm, and he had surgery, and he's not able to be with us today. But he has been an advocate for safe tattooing for years. He approached me in 2007 about creating a licensure process for body artists and establishments. Using models such as Oregon State Tattoo Regulation and Minnesota's Hennepin County Regulations, Mr. Wells has worked with other tattooists to create a state regulation that protects both artists and clients. And it also has some other good benefits to our blood sources in our state because people that are having tattoos in unregulated facilities need to wait a year before they can donate blood, which has slowed down the collection of blood for our blood banks and for the Red Cross. So this is important language for us to pass. As leaders in their field, advocates have asked for a responsible state policy of licensure and regulation, and this is an opportunity for the state legislature to work with the tattoo industry proactively. This bill has passed Health, Housing, and Family Security, Judiciary, and Commerce, and is now before this division. Now, I just again received the preliminary fiscal note, and I'm a little alarmed about the cost of the licensure fees of $1,000 for the establishments. And, Madam Chair, I think it needs some work, and I need some time to work with the department on this. It also has a fiscal impact of $5,000 the first year.
Right.
$34,000.
We traditionally what we do is we balance it out over a four-year period. It's not unusual for the special revenue fund to carry a new licensure initially as long as the fund gets paid back in the years after you've been collecting the fees for a while.
Well, you can see that it would be neutral then over the
right.
4 years.
It would be.
Yes. So
keep it all together and put it in the omnibus bill or send it all to the omnibus bill. So I guess I have to keep the whole thing.
And in this case, Senator Pretner Solon, because this is a new licensure, we would either need to keep the bill in the omnibus bill or send it separately with the appropriations attached to it, because we can't have the, I mean, we can't just have the fees without all of the licensure that goes with it.
Right. Madam Chair, I would prefer that it stay in the omnibus bill if you're okay with that.
Okay. Are there any questions about either the bill or the fiscal note? No questions, no discussion. Then Senator Pretner Solon will just lay this over for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 1766 is the Chemical Health Care Home Pilot Program, which will redesign the structural relationship between the state and the counties, which would create better accountability and productivity and results in Minnesota when we're dealing with our chemical health arena. This pilot would align the systemic incentives of services and payment to the appropriate levels, similar to our healthcare home model, and it would create a capitated funding model for voluntary participation of counties to best manage the cases as they see necessary as evidence-based practices. This model, the counties would negotiate with the Department of Human Services on agreements dealing with performance and governance and service. And, Madam Chair and members, the budget is supposed to be neutral or even produce a cost savings, but I just received the preliminary fiscal note this morning myself, and I'm surprised and a little stunned by this fiscal note, and I kind of have to chuckle because there has been a lot of astounding fiscal notes coming out. But I am actually just going to turn it over to Kelly Harder from Steele County, who can address specifically the fiscal note, and that's why we're here in front of you, Madam Chair. I do think this pilot program has great potential. I know it has some problems in its dealing with the federal waivers, and they are actually meeting with the department later this morning, I believe, to deal with the federal waivers. And there is some discrepancy in this fiscal note that Kelly Harder would like to address, Madam Chair.
And while we're hearing from him, Senator Rosen, a thought occurred to me that, you know, there is the concept of total value purchasing we've been working on as a cost savings idea, mm-hmm. and that perhaps the counties in conjunction with the providers in that area could apply to do this through that concept and avoid some of these difficulties.
Absolutely. Madam Chair, I think that's a great idea, and I believe there's a lot of potential in this concept, whether you're looking at that idea or the proposal to consolidate to the 15 counties and human services. It's the same concept, but there is a tremendous area, tremendous growth or potential in the chemical health arena and how we deliver chemical health treatment.
Welcome to our committee.
Madam Chair, thank you. Committee members, my name is Kelly Harder. I'm the Human Service Director in Steele County, also co-chair for the MAXA Legislative Committee. And we want to thank you first and foremost for allowing us to bring this bill and Senator Rosen for authoring this bill for us. You all, we've been in front of you over years talking about the challenges within the Consolidated Treatment Fund mm-hmm. and its maintenance of efforts issues. Out of respect to the budget and the realities of our economy, You don't see us in front of you asking for $250,000 to rebalance that out this year. But instead we thought, you know, many of us have spoken over years, governor's office, legislative branch, and others, about our frustration and challenges within the outcomes or the lack thereof of outcomes within the consolidated fund. We as counties have experimented with in partnering with the state and other areas and have seen and brought forth some outcomes that we believe we could build upon. However, a lot of those services at times are restricted from the consolidated fund. We are proposing for you today a model that we do strongly believe has potential to bring a greater all-over return on investment to the taxpayer, most importantly to the consumers. We have a model that is about purchasing outcomes, not purchasing process. I want to first and foremost also acknowledge that it's a complicated formula. There is federal money in here. But last I checked, and I might be wrong with this, but it's a $121.6 million line item. Of that $121.6 million, $8 million of that is federal Medicaid money, and it would require a non-federal match. So let's take $16 million off that. That leaves $104 million, as I understand it, and I'm open from the department to be corrected on that, $104 million of state and county money that we have some work that we could flexibly work on. In no way, shape, or form would I sit in front of you or the counties even propose putting at jeopardy $8 million in this with the feds. We think we've had a model. I've been able to have some conversation with John Zakel, who put the fiscal note together the other night at another committee hearing, and we look forward to meeting with the department at 11 o'clock this morning to work this out. So in no way, shape, or form are we going to put at jeopardy federal money. And given the realities of some waivers or the history of those, we want to find a way to do this and innovate and create this opportunity while complying to the federal mandate and so on and so forth with that. Once again, we would like to propose, and yes, as counties, we're saying, we'd like to look at a three-year historic spending of the consolidated fund and ask for that in a capitation. Then within that, we assume full risk of any expenditures related to the eligible individuals, and we're not looking to serve in individuals who would fall outside of the consolidated. We're not looking to not comply with current rules and regulations within the consolidated fund or Rule 25 assessments. We want to follow the assessment work that's been done recently, a lot of good work in Rule 31. And we want to work, though, within those bookends. We want to work creatively and innovatively because we believe strongly in that model of that healthcare home and truly integrating care coordination. This gives us an opportunity to integrate chemical health with mental health with primary health care. We know well over 60% of our mental health folks have primary chemical health related issues, yet there continues to be a challenge within the rigid framework of the consolidated fund to get that money through dual diagnosis programs to interplay itself as well as we think it could. We know that housing and employment, transportation, and other related issues tie directly to a person's abstinence and their ability to stay functional within the community, being tax-paying citizens. So we believe there's a lot of potential. We know there's a lot of work to do, a lot of pencils to sharpen on some of this. We look forward to working with the department in all of this. And finally, the last thing I would say to all of this is we all know there's a lot of conversation going on when the governor presented the Human Services Authority Act. We know that there's a look to redesign the system at a macro level. Very massive redesign going on. We bring you one small program. It's not irrelevant. It's $120-some million. We bring you one program. I would say I'm concerned that we see fiscal notes of this, because if we're going to fiscal note every program, how are we going to get the systems redesigned that we all as counties want to embrace as well? You cannot overhaul a system to 15 or 30 or 45 at a macro level when we can't even get to a fiscal note here. I have well over half the population of counties, what I call non-committally committed, to being part of this pilot. We'd cover over half the state's population, well over. That tells you how much potential they think lies within this, and we as counties aren't going to fiscal note that, but we're going to commit staff time, energies, and resources to get it done. We're not putting we do not want to put that federal dollar at risk. So to that, we still need to work through the details. We appreciate that. I do not believe that we would have a $10.9 million fiscal note. And if we do, help us all, because I don't know how we redesign the large system when one small little program has a $10 million fiscal note. Thank you very much. I'll answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm very interested in this proposal because I know that at least one of the counties in my district, Beltrami County, has talked a lot about this and is also interested in it. So I'm interested in how this kind of whole structure would work. And I'm sure no one knows exactly what they're going to do. There are probably a lot of ideas out there. But I would just say that my concern, I mean, I think the idea on its face sounds good, you know, allowing for some flexibility and allowing for creative ways of making sure that taxpayers' money is spent in a way that's the most effective in terms of best practices. But my concern is just that as we're looking at this, that we're careful, because when we have capitated payments, as we talked about with special transportation services yesterday, there can sometimes be an incentive not to spend the money on the service. I noticed that your bill requires that if there are savings, they have to be put back into the treatment of and I think that's good, because I think that removes that kind of financial incentive to try to do, not put the money into the service. But then my other concern is just that we're careful that we don't take money that could be going towards service delivery and add to the costs of that middle layer of management and administration. And so I just throw that out there as a caution, that we try to be careful that we're not taking money away from where the services could be used and that we're actually just trying to make sure we use it more effectively.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, my response to you to that is thank you, because we too are very concerned, and we've had with a lot of other programs in managed care and health care and other things, county-based purchasing, you know, there's a lot of models that are out there for us to learn from. The one thing I would respond to assure you is that the system is inherently aligned for us not to do what I will call cost-cutting savings, because if we cut costs on one end, we know where we're going to end up paying. And the county pays detox, they pay sheriff costs, they pay jail costs, they pay. So if we're not doing what I like about a model like this is it truly aligns the service delivery system at the level of care. And that if we try to do any shortcuts along there, the county's going to pay one way or the other. And currently under the consolidated, because it's so rigid in that way, the system isn't quite aligned systemically like it could be, that there's an inherent incentive for us to stay committed and making sure. It's like the healthcare home. How do we get the providers the right amount of resources to incentivize the right amount of care so they get them the care so that they don't get sick again? Because guess what? It's coming back to them. And we have a payment structure and methodology that keeps everyone committed to that same end goal. So I really appreciate your comments on that. Thank you.
And so are there any other questions? Senator Prettner-Sullen.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Senator Rosen, thank you for bringing this proposal forward. I think it's innovative and something that we really want to foster. And it's really frustrating that state government is so rigid that we can't create efficiencies or cost savings or better delivery of care without incurring such additional expense. And for me, that is the most frustrating thing, that we get locked into re-delivering things the way we've always delivered them because we can't get out of the cost of moving forward.
Well, Senator Prettner-Sullen, I think there's a way for this to be done without having these kind of costs. And I think, but I did want you to get the concept in front of the division. And, you know, I think what they're really talking about doing is moving to a total cost of care concept for chemically dependent clients that would otherwise be in public programs. And so I think they probably have a little more work to do on the language of the bill, actually, and then I think we might be able to see something that would be more workable. So,
thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Prettner-Sullen. Really, I need to thank Senator Berglund and Senator Lurie for that, because they're in full support and actually sent it my way. But this is the direction that we need to be heading, and we just need to bring everybody to the table to figure out how to make this work without a $10 million for FTEs, which I'm a little surprised about. So we'll continue the discussion.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. The other issue in this preliminary note relates to an assumption that the federal government would allow for the waiver, and so we have to absorb losses of federal dollars there. And I mean, besides the state's rigidity, that just is so appalling that we can't get through a waiver process at the federal level that would, in the end, create cost savings for all of us. And I just, is that true? Is that likely to happen, that this waiver would not be approved on the basis that we would be allowing for a pilot?
Well, I just might remind the department and whoever worked on this fiscal note that we're in the middle of doing a pilot for counties to take total cost of care for mental health. And, I mean, we didn't have to get a waiver to do that. So, you know, I think there's a way this can happen without having all of these dire things that are in the fiscal note needing to happen. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Rosen. On the preliminary fiscal note, it's been stated, I think, somehow as fiscal notes are prepared, there needs to be a mechanism to show that we are, in essence, we are reorganizing or redesigning the work that's being done at the department level. And that is missing or not clearly noted in the fiscal note. It shouldn't be that difficult. We do business this way today. We are proposing to do business differently. What's happening to those four FTEs currently, or whatever the number is, that are working currently in this area? So that's a question that I have. I've read this about four times because I'm trying to think if I'm reading this correctly, but on page two of the fiscal note, forgive me, but it just seems to be a little bit of editorializing, which I'm not sure if is really necessary or appropriate in this document, because much of the assurance of client access rights and protections are going to be removed by this legislation. Contracting with participate counties will be complicated and time-consuming and so on and so forth. Just not sure that that's really necessary or helpful. But Senator Rosen, on a positive note, I think that what you are doing here, it could be hopefully kind of the impetus or the pilot for the overall county redesign, and how exciting that is. But my goodness, if we are having this much difficulty working through one small component of a much larger system, I really hope that we can really drill down and work on this particular fiscal note, because I think it's going to pave the way for much more work that's going to be done.
So I agree this has a lot of promise, which is one of the reasons that I encourage the counties to find a different author than myself, since I'm a little bogged down with trying to save money and
Madam Chair.
A variety of ways. But I do think this has a lot of promise, and that's why I think it's important for us to urge the department and the parties involved in it to work on maybe redoing the language in a way that it can work better without getting this kind of fiscal note. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to suggest the possibility of maybe the language related to the waivers, if the language were simply changed to say that reflects the bill being contingent on obtaining those waivers, you'd lose about half of your fiscal note that way, or more than half, I think, the way I'm reading this. And the other thing that I would say is, you know, not just with this proposal, but with a lot of the reform proposals across the board, just to kind of add to, I think, some of the comments that have been made here already, if we're going to, in a budget deficit time, be told by all of the different departments whenever a reform proposal is made, and I think I share your frustration with this, that we can't do it because it's going to be an added cost, then to me that's no different than whether it's my house budget or my any other budget. You know, we can look within our own budgets and find ways to juggle our priorities to get through a reform process, or we can say that we have to have the status quo or we're going to add a cost so we can't do anything. And it seems to me that when the department does this, they require us to avoid giving them the flexibility they would have within their own budget to decide how to absorb these costs, as opposed to if we really want the reform, saying, okay, then if you, then we'll have to decide where to take the money away from you. So I guess I would just ask the departments to keep that in mind, that maybe some of these reforms are needed and we need a little bit of cooperation in order to try to make them happen.
Well, and I would say that if there are going to be savings generated out of this idea, which seems like there would be, that possibly then some of the state share would go down and we could take any staffing requirements out of the savings.
Madam Chair. I would agree, and I just want to say that the department is ready and willing to come to the table and talk about this. So I don't know if they're as surprised as I am about this, but they definitely want to see this move forward. So.
Okay, well, good luck to you. We'll set this aside then, and hopefully when you're ready, let me know when you're ready if you have amendments. And, okay. Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate File 704 is a bill that would require the Commissioner of Health, in consultation with the Minnesota Administrative Uniformity Committee, Commissioner of Human Service, and the Commissioner of Commerce, to study and make recommendations on the feasibility and barriers to simplifying healthcare administrative transactions through electronic data interchange and establishing a single standardized system. And the study would identify a range of potential technologies to accomplish this. I have with me Phil Rivness from the Minnesota Medical Group Management Association.
Welcome to our committee. We are trying to kind of focus on the fiscal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I totally understand, and we discussed this at some length in policy. But just to reiterate, one of the reasons we brought this bill forward, and I think one of the reasons it is supported by the legislative committee of the AUC, is because determining eligibility before service occurs and actually being able to calculate in real time what a patient owes is very consumer friendly and also extremely important in terms of cost savings. At any point in time, a provider, whether a hospital or a clinic in this state, can see bills from as many as 1,000 different insurance companies. Now, clearly, four or five big ones account for many of them. But each of them have a different process for determining whether or not a patient is eligible for services. It's overly complex. Other regions of the country have done far better than we have to take this administrative complexity out. And we think there's an opportunity here for public and private payers, consumers, and providers to have tremendous gains. What the fiscal note alludes to from the Department of Health particularly is that if this bill passes, some of the work of the AUC would have to be reprioritized. So if you look on page 3, they give an example of three kinds of issues: real-time claims adjudication, reducing and standardizing claims attachments, and rapid development of medical coding conventions and codes, all of which are important. But we happen to believe that establishing eligibility and determining deductibles precedes any one of these. So we would suggest that if in the wisdom of the committee, you could see this as just a reprioritization of the work of the AUC, which has staff assigned to it. Lots of volunteers, by the way, put in thousands of hours representing health plans, providers, and others who have an interest in this. That's kind of what at least the way I read the fiscal note. Obviously, I defer to the wisdom of this committee, but we think that this is terribly important. People often talk about administrative waste. This is an example of administrative waste. Simplifying will provide more efficiency, but also better information for consumers. So I strongly recommend your consideration of this bill.
Okay. Senator Dahl, the first thing that we need to talk about is the role of the Department of Commerce in relationship to this bill, because funding for the Department of Commerce is not in this division. And so our suggestion would be that you delete that language, and people can always talk to each other without having being directed to do so in legislation, and that would deal with part of the fiscal note issues here.
Madam Chair.
Does that sound to you, Senator?
Very good. We've already talked about that, and we would be more than willing to omit the Commissioner of Commerce and part of the study group.
And we'll direct Senate Counsel to work on that while we discuss some of the rest of this. It's up to the committee, but my own feeling is that it's not really a wise thing to reprioritize the work of the Department of Health and the e-technology committee, because they're in the middle of doing e-prescribing. They're in the middle of also doing uniform payment mechanisms. So I don't think it's really a wise thing for us to ask them to stop doing that work, to start doing this work. That doesn't mean that this isn't important. It just means that, as a fiscal note says, there perhaps need to be some more resources if we're going to go ahead with this work. And I don't know, Senator Dahl, if we can find the resources. They're fairly small, especially in comparison to the $350,000 request to keep the work going in the first place. Senator Prettner-Solin.
Madam Chair.
That was a request from the department, I might add.
Thank you.
What would happen if it just got in line with the other?
Well, then it would happen later, as I believe. And maybe we can ask the Department of Health to come up and tell us how much later.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Golden, Director of Health Policy at the Department of Health.
Welcome, Mr. Golden.
With regard to the question of how much later, I think it depends a little bit. There's actually quite a few things that are required in this bill. Some of them would happen reasonably quickly. So, for example, there's some activities in here that look at the e-prescribing requirements. Those are activities that are ongoing both at the Administrative Uniformity Committee as well as the e-health advisory committee. I would anticipate that those issues happen over the course of between now and 2011, just as we're working on e-prescribing and as trying to implement it to meet the mandate. Some of the issues that Mr. Rivness raised with regard to eligibility, I can tell you that the very first thing that will be worked on at the committee is getting into compliance with changes in federal law in the changing of the version on all eligibility claims and remittance advice. That's the number one priority of all providers and payers in the state. That will be occupying the committee until the end of the calendar year. After that, I would anticipate that the eligibility question about getting providers better information about eligibility, so if a patient has a high deductible, what the actual deductible costs are, that is a high priority for all providers, and I would anticipate that that is something that the AUC would like to look at in the next calendar year to some degree. Their ability to solve it I can't answer, but I know it's an issue that they'd like to take up. Some of the other issues that are in the bill, particularly around lines 1.11 through 1.15, prior authorization, service notification, retroactive denial, I'm not sure that those are likely to be issues that are going to be dealt with in the next 18 months. Those would be probably 2 years or further out. I would say the other issue that I think is outside of the Administrative Uniformity Committee is the Administrative Uniformity Committee tends to deal with the transactions. What are the actual data standards that are being transmitted? How do we have those to be common between providers and payers? The idea of having a single portal to which all of the transaction goes. The only state who's really successfully done that is Utah with the UHIN model. I do know that there are some payers who are interested in looking at that issue. You know, MNHI, the Minnesota Health Information Exchange, has been focused on clinical data, but they do have an interest in those types of issues because they would like to be able to link the clinical and the administrative. So I would anticipate that that's likely to happen, but it would be at a venue that would be more at the community level and not as much at the direction of the Commissioner of Health.
Are there questions? So, Senator Dahl, how do you feel about having these things, having the department directed to look at these things, but not having it be done immediately? In the case of the ones that they aren't planning to look at immediately, anyway.
Madam Chair, if it means not at all, I think later is better than never.
So maybe we could work on some language about that also. Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, there's this Office of Enterprise Technology. I'm not sure what they do, and I'm not sure if they're affiliated or separate, but I'm wondering if we're connecting the dots between what one particular agency is doing and what the overall sort of technology plan is for the state. The reason I bring this up is because I was in a conversation this week over technology needs for the state of Minnesota for our various departments and agencies. And so on the one hand, we're trying to give guidance in terms of what we'd like to have accomplished by those particular entities, but is there any correlation here between kind of the work that we want to have done and this? They're kind of a coordinated plan.
Senator Lynch, I don't think that has anything to do with this. This has to do with trying to get the health insurance and health plan companies and the providers of health care in the state using systems that will do things in a uniform fashion. So it isn't so much about what state government is doing, it's more about the private sector.
Well, Madam Chair, and Senator Dahl, let me just say that it seems to me that we tend to kind of look at all of this sort of individually, you know, take care of this problem for the immediate. We've already seen that there's a long list. I'm just suggesting that, I don't know, I guess I need more information on whoever this Office of Enterprise Technology is, but I'd like to know that there's some sort of connection between all of this. Senator Prettner-Solin.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
It's sort of like the Iron Range Resource that takes care of mining and that type of, and the Natural Resources Research Institute takes care of, there's the agricultural, another institute, and then there's ARI for energy, or there's an energy institute. They all have their different areas, but they're really about developing innovation and getting the private sector involved in innovation in those different areas. And it really doesn't have much to do with our electronic record.
Madam Senate Counsel, are you ready to read a suggestion here?
Madam Chair, I think to take care of all the concerns, if we start on page 1, line 6, take out paren, little a, n paren. And line 7, delete, comma, the Commissioner of Commerce, comma. And then on page 2, delete lines 4 through 6.
How does that sound to you, Senator Dahl?
Madam Chair, I believe that sounds good.
Hey, Senator Olson, would you like to move that amendment for Senator Dahl?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to.
All right. Did you have a question or a comment?
Yes, I did, Madam Chair. I just wanted to follow up quickly with what Senator Lynch and Senator Prettner-Solin said. The issue of e-technology is an issue that we dealt with in data practices, and there are certainly data practices connotations around patients' medical records. And I just want, one of the concerns I had is when I found that some of the ways these systems were being set up, people are being charged as much as $2 or more a page to get copies of records in some cases. And the way the systems are designed electronically, they're only getting one line a page. So in one case, it cost someone over $17,000 to get copies of their medical records. We had that testimony. And yet we were told they could not be stored electronically, so someone could just get it on a disk. So there's a financial incentive because there's a profit involved in making these copies. And I guess, so that just brings me back to the idea of the bigger picture of looking at this, if government dollars are being spent to make sure that these systems are designed in a not just a cost savings way from the standpoint of streamlining things through technology, but also making sure they're consumer friendly. And somehow looking at what's going on out there comprehensively, I think would be a good idea.
Well, I'm sure you'll keep working on it. We're counting on it. So any further discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. And then I don't know, Senator Dahl, this could be included in the omnibus bill. We're still working on the department request of $350,000 for continuing this work. So it may be that that would be something that we could include in the omnibus bill, assuming that we find some money for the department's request. Or you could have the bill go separately, whatever you prefer.
Madam Chair, did the change of the taking out of the due date and taking out commerce then eliminate the fiscal implication?
I believe so.
Then if we could go separately, that might be good.
Okay. Then I just would instruct you one thing. If the House has not made these changes in the bill, you cannot agree to the House language without discussing it with me.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. We can't have bills floating out there that change along the way and get fiscal notes that we're not tracking. So, would Senator Laurie like to make the motion for Senator Dahl that Senate File 704, as amended, be recommended to pass? Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee.
All right. Okay, I think we're up to me now.
Next, we'll move on to Senate File 825. That's number 12 on the agenda. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members of the division, this bill is really a result of the request that's gone out to the public to make suggestions about ways to save money within state government. And it was amazing to me the number of people that responded to that request. by suggesting that there be one person that they talk to when they're making their Minnesota Care applications. And the gist of it is that many of these people feel that every time they talk to somebody, they're talking to somebody different, and the person they're talking to doesn't seem to know anything that's gone on with the person that they talked to previously. And so from their perspective, they're seeing this as being wasteful and duplicative because they're having to start all over again with wherever their application is every time they talk to somebody new. And so that was the impetus for the bill. And, of course, what's happened in regard to the department's response in drafting a fiscal note is that they're asking for more people. I still think this is a good idea to bring to the committee to think about, and I would say that there's one of three things that we could do. One, we could just leave things the way they are, and people can keep getting a different person every time they call up. Or number two, we can require the department to do this and not with the staff that they have. Or number three, we can provide additional resources for more staffing. I think those are kind of the three options. And I know there's folks from the department here that worked on the fiscal note, and I guess if you have questions, maybe you can ask them about it.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund. When I was in private practice and used to have to call in to get call into the department to find out how much they had spent on behalf of a particular person before I could settle their case. They had people assigned to that, and you just told them what the last name of your client was, and by alphabetical order of that last name, they had divided up the workload, and you were assigned to that person. And I'm just wondering why we couldn't do the same thing with this without adding expense. Just say, okay, if we have 50 people working in this area, this person's going to be responsible for everyone with a last name from here to here and so forth and so on, and then you would automatically go to that person. Does it have to be so complicated?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, my understanding from talking to the department about this is that they have some backroom functions that are performed by some staff, and then they have some functions that are performed by staff that interface with clients. It wouldn't be my intention with this bill that the backroom functions would have to be performed by the same person, but that the interfacing work that's done with the applicant, that would be done by the same person, so that, you know, they open up the file and they see, oh, yes, I remember I talked to this person and they needed this piece of information or that piece of information, and now they're on the phone again, and they apparently they have this piece of information, and so then I could tell them that the piece of information they sent looks like it's complete, and so we don't need any more information from them, rather than sort of starting over again. That was my idea with the bill. But there are backroom functions also that are done by the department after they get all of the information from an applicant. Needed to have the same person handling those functions. So I don't think you could just divide it up by alphabet like you're suggesting.
Senator Prentner-Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But I'm wondering if we could have the department come and justify for us such a high fiscal note. If they're going to be responding to the same number of people, why does it cost so much more?
We'd like to invite the department to come forward and visit.
And Madam Chair, why restructuring couldn't occur to accommodate it?
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephanie Radke, and I am Director of the Healthcare Eligibility and Access Division. Just to provide some context, Minnesota Care Operations at the state, we process over 40,000 actually over 43,000 Minnesota Care cases, representing over 82,000 individuals across the state. We have attempted over the last several years to model our operations after industry best practices in order to meet our statutory processing guidelines and provide good customer service. It isn't imperfect, but I think we've done a pretty good job over the past several years of meeting our statutory guidelines in processing. What we do to increase our efficiency is we have a completely electronic system. With that number of cases, we do not have paper files and in individual desks or cases assigned to specific individuals. All work is done electronically, and depending on the particular needs of the operation throughout the month, we do have a very cyclical business. I mean, and our number one goal is to maintain coverage for people and to ensure that we process renewals and people are renewed and maintain their coverage in a timely manner. And what that has required us to do is we break up work according to different work queues. We have a work queue for renewals. So we want to make sure at the end of the month that we process all of those renewals and get all of that work done on a timely basis so those people maintain coverage. The proposal, as we understand it, is a new level of customer service for the upfront application part of the process. There still are, as Senator Berglund stated earlier, other pieces of processing, the eligibility processing, that are done behind the scenes. But this does require a new level of customer service upfront for that application process. We currently receive between 4,000 and 5,000 new applications per month. And this is quite an increase given the current economic situation we're in. These are about 2006 levels we're seeing. So to take our current process where it is not dependent on a particular individual being in the office on a particular day, anyone in the operation right now is able to assist a particular client. So we'd be looking at having to put processes and systems in place to direct communications regarding the application process for 4,000 to 5,000 cases, new cases per month, to a specific individual. So that is what is resulting in the fiscal note cost and the FTE cost. And what I believe to be necessary to accomplish the objectives we have here.
Madam Chair. Senator Prentner-Solon.
Yep. Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, I still think it's worth an effort at working this out, though, because there's nothing more frustrating to somebody to have to be repeating over and over again to different people each time they call. And you can't tell me that that isn't also time-consuming on the agency's part. Mm-hmm. If there were one person who understood the case and could follow it through, it's got to be a more streamlined process.
Senator Berglund.
Senator Prentner-Solon, I agree. I mean, I did not think this idea would have huge savings, actually, but I did think it would improve customer service, and I certainly did think that it should be able to be accomplished without additional expense.
Senator Lori.
You know, I mean, somebody is talking to these people mm-hmm. on the telephone now. And in some cases, many people are talking to them on the telephone now. And from what they're relaying to us, they're talking about the same things to many people on the telephone over and over again. So it does seem to me that, you know, it is taking up some of the staff time to have this person's story being repeated. And so it would seem to me that there should be able to be some reallocation of duties now. You know, the issue of getting more people in the door because of the economy, that's a different issue. And I think, you know, if the department needs more staff because we're getting more applicants, that's a different issue, and we should be addressing that kind of a request. But that isn't what this bill's about.
Senator Lorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think most of my – I was going to make many of the same points. I mean, I think, you know, in talking with people, this is a consistent complaint. I mean, they're talking about multiple calls covering the same topic over and over again with different people each time. And, I mean, it's consistent across the state. I mean, and it just it baffles one to try to imagine that – there wouldn't be a cost savings in trying to, I mean, maybe not a huge one, but these multiple calls with different answers, people are pulling their hair out, chasing their tail, and there's somebody answering each of these phone calls too. I mean, I think that through this restructuring, this is, we didn't just dream this up. This came from the applicants out there in the field trying to negotiate this process. I mean, so... I mean, it may be modeled after a business industry, but it's not one that's working very well for the people.
Okay, lots of comments. I'm going to go Senator Olson, Sharon Rosen. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just quickly say when you're dealing with an insurance company, they have systems in place that will get you back to the adjuster handling your case by just having a claim number, or if you know the name of the person that's dealing with your case. I can see maybe a one-time cost in adjusting a little bit of your technology to direct that person, but once you've taken care of that, it would seem to me that this would actually save you money because you're not going to have all that time spent on repeating things, as other people have said. But I think there's another factor besides the frustration consumer factor, and I can relate to that with my own personal experiences, but I also think there's an issue of accountability. And if you have one person who's primarily responsible for dealing with that consumer, that customer, it's much more likely they're going to feel the responsibility on their shoulders for the outcome. And so I think that's another valuable part of doing this.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator. It just strikes me that the application coordinators that we're talking about that the client is assigned to is facilitating initial and ongoing communications with the applicant, that's achievable. Maybe if somebody's sick for a long period of time, it creates a problem, but if there was a language change that would say, I think people assume that in those circumstances, you couldn't follow through with this, that you'd have to allow somebody else to be available during that time. I don't think there's anything in this that would not allow the agency to have a backup person cover for in somebody's absence.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will concur with everybody here, too, and just saying that I think there is a need for a one-stop shop to create this, do it a little more streamlining in the area. But I guess my question to Mrs. Radke is it says here in the assumptions, application coordinators will possess high-level customer service skills, advanced competencies in written and verbal communication, case management, problem-solving, and conflict resolution. I would assume, so if we do have an application coordinator, are they going to have to be trained and educated in all the areas of this, which is probably, I could see initial cost, but eventually, once you have that initial cost, everybody should be at the same level. Is that correct? And you could handle cases.
Ms. Radke.
Madam Chair, yes. The application coordinators should be at that level. Mm-hmm. We are still proposing to maintain what we characterize as kind of the back-end eligibility processing for efficiency purposes, where those people would not be responsible to be on the phone and connecting with clients. We have found and believe that there are very different staff competencies needed to efficiently process an application, I think, versus communicating with an applicant, particularly those in very complex situations. These are complex programs. The application process is complex, I realize. And I think we could use people with higher level customer service skills to interact with our applicants and assist with that application process. I support this proposal. I think it's a good idea.
Well, Ms. Radke, thank you very much for those comments. Senator Berglund, how would you like to proceed with your bill?
Well, I think we should just lay it over for further consideration and possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. All right. And Senator Berglund, we have one item left on our agenda. It's Senate File 1474. I'll leave it up to you. Would you like to proceed?
I think this will be real quick.
Okay, here we go. Senate File 1474.
This bill deals with our healthcare homes, and it just requires the department to seek a federal waiver so that if we have more than one healthcare home available, that then a client would be required, if they are with a provider providing a healthcare home, that that's where they would be doing all of their business, rather than, you know, saying, yes, I'm with you as a healthcare home, but next week I'm going over to see you and you. And then that isn't even known by the people that are working to provide a healthcare home atmosphere. And the department doesn't think it'll have any savings because they still don't know how many people are going to actually, how many providers are going to want to be healthcare homes. But I think that if we could get this waiver, that it would encourage more providers to actually sign up to be healthcare homes.
So, Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, that doesn't prevent them from being referred to a different system,
no.
But their primary medical home would be remain
home
consistent.
Home base would be the same.
Okay.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Berglund, it just sounds like it's something that we missed in the. We knew this. There was going to be tweaks and changes to the bill last year, but this is just one of them.
Yes, I wasn't aware that
Senator
this.
Berglund.
I wasn't aware we needed a waiver for this to happen until this year. So then I would just move that this be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill also.
Good work, members. Meeting is adjourned.